Discovery Project, LIGO for short. And he became director of the LIGO Laboratory in 1997. LIGO is a National Science Foundation-funded project to detect gravitational waves from distant sources, such as colliding black holes. 4-kilometer LIGO interferometers located in Washington State and Louisiana are designed to detect ripples in space-time far smaller than the size of a proton. LIGO is now into the commissioning stage and has already provided useful information in this area. Dr. Barish's topic tonight is a reflection on the contribution of Einstein to our understanding of the universe. His topic is Albert Einstein's Legacy, Our Best Description of the Universe. Dr. Barish.
It's a pleasure to be here. It's always good to have a nice captive audience. I'm going to give you a talk today that is very complex. I'll try to make it simple. It's also different than usually a physics talk that most of us could give right now, because usually when we talk about the most forefront problems in physics, they're very new. In fact, usually among physicists, we tend to have an in-joke that last year's discovery is this year's background, meaning basically that the ideas are really new, the data is new. This problem that I'm going to talk about today traces itself back almost 100 years, and so I'm going to give you some history. I'm going to talk about some of the most advanced technology that's been created to help us solve a problem that's been around almost 100 years. And I'm going to talk about a rather complex subject that not too many people understand called general relativity. Not very much about it, but just a little bit. So tighten your seatbelts, and we'll start. First with Albert Einstein himself. And it's interesting that a scientist was labeled by Time magazine, as we turned into this new century, as the person of the century. And I think it's a reflection of the image of Einstein himself and his contribution to science, and maybe the image of science in modern society. At least I like to hope and think that's true. That's by Time magazine. In physics itself, we've labeled this year now, the World Year of Physics. And this is the poster for the World Years of Physics, and there's many celebrations around the globe having to do with this year. The reason we picked this year has to do with Einstein himself and the fact that 1905, exactly 100 years ago, was what is labeled as the miraculous year. And I want to take you through that just a little bit before I get into where we go on to the subject that touches what we're doing now to understand the universe, as I label the title. That year we call Annus Mirabilis, which is the miracle year. And during that year, Einstein emerged from having worked in a patent office, where he did technical things, but working in a patent office, to write 5 revolutionary scientific papers in a very short time on a variety of subjects. And they allowed us, I'm going to talk about it just briefly, but they allowed us to change our understanding of what light is. I'll try to point that out. He proved the existence of atoms and molecules. And he established the whole concept of what's called special relativity. These are 3 very, very different subjects. And as I said, in a short sentence, that's what I would label as kind of the impact of these contributions that he made in just a matter of weeks in the year 1905. So what did he tell us about light? In terms of light, the question that was there is one that I'll just try to briefly address, and that is the behavior of light, something that acts like a wave or like a particle. By a wave, you mean something like a radio wave, and a particle is something like the things we're made of, protons, or in this case, photons. Einstein is quoted as calling this question so enormously important and difficult that everybody should work on it. That's at that time. So what do we mean by waves? Light itself is often described as waves. And sunlight is waves. Radio is waves. We all know that's radio waves. And those are both forms of light itself. But they have different wavelengths, and one of them then is what we call radio waves, and one of them is sunlight. But they're waves, and that's a description of waves. The colors that you see in a rainbow also demonstrate a wave-like nature of light. While at the same time, light can be described as particles. And light is described as particles. The particle that we call light, when we call it a particle, is called a photon. So it can be described as a photon, and probably the best and easiest example to grapple with is the picture here, which is a solar cell. In the solar cell, a photon comes and strikes an atom, and when it strikes an atom, it generates electricity by knocking an electron out of that atom. And so it behaves like a particle that comes in and scatters an electron out. That's an effect that Einstein wrote about in 1905. It's called the photoelectric effect. So in one short picture, that's the picture of light that he brought together. And this is a precursor for later when quantum mechanics was developed later in the century. The second topic that he addressed in 1905 was atoms. And here, the question that was posed is, how do we know that atoms or molecules exist? We didn't at that time have any microscope or way to look inside of an atom and see what it's made of, inside of a molecule and see what it's inside of a nucleus and see what it's made of. And so he attempted to understand or prove that that there were atoms and molecules inside, essentially circumstantially from what they would do if they were inside. And he hypothesized that if atoms do exist, then they have to bump into each other. And if they bump into each other, then he can calculate what happens in these paths and develop the whole theory around that, which basically created a theory that described how they move around and actually even how big they are in order to strike each other. And this was the second contribution in 1905. The third one is relativity, and this represents the speed limit, 186,000 miles per second, which is pretty fast, but it is the speed limit. Now, what do I mean by that? Einstein argued the following, kind of philosophically, and that is that the laws of physics are going to be the same no matter what frame of reference we're in. What do I mean by a frame of reference? What I mean is from my point of view. It doesn't matter whether I'm sitting on the Earth's surface, and so my reference is sitting on the Earth's surface, or I'm in a rocket ship traveling at some velocity above the Earth's surface, the laws should be the same. And in order to reconcile that, he built a whole theory called the special theory of relativity. But one consequence of that is that he argued that therefore there has to be a constant velocity of light, and it's going to be the same for all observers in all reference frames. So they're going to measure the same speed no matter what they're doing, how they're moving. And that's the theory of relativity, or what I call the cosmic speed limit. The last contribution in 1905 was another astounding one, really. And that is, for centuries, we believed that matter and energy could never be destroyed. In other words, it's preserved no matter what. And basically, the laws that we had then were conservation of energy and conservation of mass, and they were considered to be two principles that couldn't be violated. And Einstein showed, basically, that these were fallible. And that they needed to be reconciled into a single theory that unifies mass and energy itself to be able to pull things together. And that was his famous formula, E equals mc squared. So I'm going to only show two formulas, I think two, in this three, in this talk, but that's, of course, his famous formula. These contributions that he made in 1905 are getting all this publicity, and were astounding, I think, in the sense of how much of the direction of 20th century physics was determined by what he wrote down in 1905. But in a sense, the thing I'm going to talk about next I find much more puzzling, much more interesting in one way, and that is that the discoveries that he made in 1905 were problems that existed at that time where all the pieces were there, and he was just so good that he managed to take all that information on different subjects, pull it all together very quickly, and come out with these theories. I believe that these would have all come out anyway, out of the community, maybe not as fast, but they would have basically dropped out of the community. The subject that I'm going to talk about next, I don't think would have, even probably today, because I don't even know why he did it. And that is general relativity. So he went on, after doing all this work over a matter of a few weeks in 1905, which had an enormous impact on everything we've done in physics since then, and understanding a lot about technology and nature, and spent the next 10 years with a lot of false starts. He had to learn new mathematics. He got the wrong answers for a while. And finally, in 1915, and then in a revised way in 1916, 10 years after this, he came out with the theory of general relativity. What's puzzling is why he did it, why he spent 10 years working on a theory that there was no need for. And I'll tell you what I mean by that. I don't have an answer for that, and there may be somebody that can speculate, but I don't have an answer for that. Generally, what he did was take what he had done in 1905, and that's take the theory of special relativity and apply it to another problem, and that is gravity. Put it in so it'll describe gravity, and that's the theory of general relativity. That theory that he came up with, it was totally revolutionary. It has a very complicated formula. I'm not going to describe that formula. You probably have never seen it before, but that's the basic formula of general relativity. Its features are that first it overthrew a concept that was dear to us, that is the concept of absolute space and time. In Einstein's theory, there is no absolute space and time. Gravity isn't even a force. I'll point that out to you in a minute. In this theory, we all grew up thinking it's a force. I'm going to come back to that. But in his case, it's not. It's a property of space and time itself. And then he invents a word, basically, space-time, which is the three spatial dimensions, three dimensions, plus time. And I'll point out that if you run spell check, Mr. Gates doesn't yet know this is a single word. It'll tell you to. So. So the perception of space and time in this theory is relative to each other. And I'm just going to give you kind of a pictorial description of what comes out of this and why it affects how we think about the universe and how it affects even the most modern problems that we're working on, the one that I'm working on that was described in the introduction. The last piece of this, which I'll talk about slightly, is that concentrations of mass and energy distort or warp space-time. That's a big mouthful. But I'll try to show you what that is in a picture in a minute. So this all happened in 1916, that he came out with this theory, which, as I say, it's puzzling to me why he spent 10 years developing it. Why do I say that? I'll come back to that in a minute. Let me first give you just a picture of what I've just said about warp space-time. What do I mean by that? The first idea is that this is space, these little X crosses. So it's just a sheet of plastic or whatever in space, And if you put a mass on it, it distorts it. So that's what this picture is trying to tell you. And then I'll talk a little bit about the kind of distortion. So if I put a mass on it, you can see it distorts it, or maybe even more as it moves around. So this is the first just concept, is having a mass in space distorts space itself. That's the first concept. And there's a lot of consequences of that without going back to the complicated formulas that I showed. The first one is that you can draw a picture, which I'll try to do in a cartoon here, of what happens if the Earth goes around the Sun in Einstein's picture. I said Einstein's picture says there's no force. The Sun's not pulling on the Earth. So instead of the Sun pulling on the Earth, instead of that, in this picture, what was a flat plane is distorted because of the presence of the Sun, which you'll see in just a moment, and the Earth follows the path that's most consistent with what it has. So we have the Sun distorting space, and if we drop a little marble and roll it along, it would follow a path just like the Earth does around the Sun. So let me just show that once more. So you can see the Earth going around the Sun with a distortion created by the Sun itself. Okay. Why did I say that I question why he even developed this? It's because of this gentleman here. This gentleman here is Sir Isaac Newton. And if there was a more famous scientist or physicist it would arguably be Newton. Newton, in his day, solved all the problems that existed in front of him with that little theory there, which included the fact that he described what the eccentricity of orbits, the eccentric orbits of comets, why we have tides, the precession of the Earth's axis, that it goes around and as the Earth spins, the perturbation and motion of the moon by gravity around the Sun, and so forth. So he basically unified the work of Galileo, Copernicus, and Kepler all together by his theory of gravity, which he called universal gravitation. He also, in this thing here, the Principia, set down for us the scientific method. So the scientific method that we use in science and in physics to prove things, basically its roots came back to Newton. Newton's theory of gravity, which we all learned as kids, is that we jump up and the whole Earth pulls us down. So Newton said that there was a force that pulled us down. And that theory was enormously successful in its day, and then for several hundred years after that. That's already a longer track record than Einstein's theory that we're talking about and celebrating today. He's lasted 100 years. So in Newton's case, we had this theory that we all learned as kids. This is the formula. So it's not much of a formula, but what it is that the force that pulls on you is proportional to the mass, your mass, how heavy you are, the mass of whatever's pulling on you. And if it's the whole Earth, that's what pulls you down when you jump up and down, and falls off as the square of the distance you are away. So it falls off very quickly with distance. What we didn't learn as kids is what this mysterious force is. We never asked. You jumped up and you were told that your whole Earth pulled down on you, but no one ever told you what it was that was pulling down on you. Newton didn't explain that. So he had a formula that worked, and worked very well for a couple hundred years and described a lot of phenomena, but the underlying science of why you were being pulled, he never did explain. So although the equations of nature he explained very well, the mechanism wasn't explained. And in a sense, that's why you can come along with a new theory that might be right, and Newton's theory was just phenomenologically correct. It took several hundred years before there was any indication that Newton's theory might not work for everything. So everything that was used after he died for a couple hundred years was fine, except for one, as we turned into Einstein's time at the turn of the 20th century, There was one small crack in the theory, and that small crack was the orbit of Mercury around the Sun. So this is the Sun, and as Mercury goes around the Sun, each time it goes around, it gets kicked a little bit by all the gravitational force of the Sun itself, and then the positions of all the other planets and the forces due to them and their moons and so forth, and it comes back to a slightly different place. And as this goes around and around, it makes more or less a daisy pattern. We know what the solar system is. We know where the planets are. So we can calculate how far this should have moved over. And if we use Newton's theory to calculate how far it should have moved, it's off slightly. It moves actually further than we expect. By not very much, 43 minutes of arc in a century, that's not very much, that's a small amount of an angle, but that small shift was known to be different than Newton's theory. So that was a problem that needed to be solved. I think that for most scientists at that time, the easiest solution and the accepted one was that there was something about our description of the solar system that was incomplete. If there were more planets or moons, the poles might be slightly different, and so you don't have to invent a new theory. We often in physics have small puzzles because we don't have a complete description of something, but that doesn't cause us to cause a whole revolution to come up with a completely new theory that throws away something we've used for several hundred years. So that's why I say that the motivation to develop a new theory is unclear. Einstein clearly had it. I don't understand what his motivation was, and it had an enormous impact. That difference here then might have been explained by planets or other things, but what happened is when Einstein introduced his theory in 1915, it got the right answer for this. So it had an immediate success that it got the extra 43 minutes of arc. When you calculated it by this completely different method or a completely different picture of how bodies attract each other. So that gave it success, but it didn't make it the right theory. If you introduce a new theory and it happens to describe something that's there, that doesn't make an acceptance of a new theory. Usually, you accept a new theory when it predicts something that wouldn't have been there without the new theory. And that also existed in Einstein's theory. So the first thing he did was to predict, was to calculate that the orbit of Mercury and get the right answer. The second thing he did was make a prediction. And that prediction was rather astounding. And that prediction is based on the fact that you have curvature of space and time. If I have the Sun and it distorts everything around it, then it doesn't matter whether it's the Earth going by or some planet or some ball or even light. It doesn't have to have a massive object like Newton's theory. So Einstein predicted immediately that light would bend if it came near a massive object. Not only that, he predicted how you could measure it. And the idea was to watch a star. It normally would give a straight beam of light to the Earth. As it passes behind the Sun, if it passes behind the Sun and it's near the Sun, this light beam would bend and you could register the bending of the light beam if you could see it. That's hard to do because the Sun's very bright. You can't look at a star going behind the Sun. So the way it was done, or the idea was, to pick a time when the Sun goes into an eclipse. And when it goes into an eclipse and it's dark, if it happens to be just the right time, then you can follow a star that goes behind it and see the curvature. An expedition was made to do that in 1919. And that was done by this gentleman here, called Arthur Eddington, who became Sir Arthur Eddington as a result of this. And in 1919, he took an expedition to the Southern Hemisphere at the time of an eclipse of the Sun and took data as the eclipse happened and concluded that light was bent. Not only was it bent, but it was bent exactly the amount predicted by Einstein. That discovery in 1919 is actually the thing that made Einstein a household name. That hit every paper in the world. Einstein became a folk hero. Every lecture he gave by the year 1920 had 2,000 people there, even if they couldn't understand what he mumbled when he was standing on the board. You can actually see this effect, even with the naked eye, if you go to the southern hemisphere. So if you take a trip to Australia or somewhere in the southern hemisphere, there's actually one object in the sky, which is called Einstein's cross, which is due to exactly this effect. And that is that there's what's called a quasar image that appears around the central glow of a galaxy. This is a galaxy. There's a quasar, which I won't talk about, but a source of light behind. And the beams of light behind get bent around and give these four bright objects. And that is known in the sky. You can see it with your naked eye. And as I say, is a result and explained by Einstein's theory. It would not be explained by Newton. And it's one of the reasons that I say Einstein's legacy is the best description of the universe. We can look at very simple things. I'll talk about complicated things in a while. But we can look at very simple things in the sky and see the effect of Einstein's theory of general relativity in almost everyday existence there. This effect of the bending of light has become a very interesting and important tool for astronomers. Now we have a way to see an object even if it's not bright. Because as we watch any object cross the sky, if all of a sudden the light beam bends, it's because there's something in front of it that's causing it to bend. And so there's now more or less a cottage industry in astronomy which uses the fact that light bends. We call it lensing of light or microlensing of light from objects in astronomy, and it's one of the tools that's been developed over the last 10 or 20 years. Okay. I'm going to go on to the rest of this lecture to the third thing that came out of the theory of general relativity. And that is something called gravitational waves. And it's what I spend my time on and what this project that was mentioned in the introduction is about. And it's the last piece of what was the physical predictions of general relativity in 1916. So Einstein predicted this in 1916. It was really important in the sense that everything I said about Newton's theory was just what was missing. He didn't explain what the force was. That didn't mean the theory was no good. He just didn't have an idea what the force was. However, there was a conceptual problem. In Newton's theory, it has something which I'll use the fancy term, instantaneous action at a distance. What do I mean by that? What I mean by that is when the apple falls, you, the observer, watching the apple fall, see it immediately when it falls. Well, that's okay. You expect to do that. But if a star collapses in the sky some millions of light years away, it's not reasonable to believe that that you would instantaneously see that. We know that the radiation that comes from light comes millions of light years later. So to get the signal immediately for gravitation seems not right. So the conceptual problem that he solved was basically the fact that in Einstein's theory of general relativity, the information itself gets carried by something called gravitational radiation, the subject I'll talk about for the rest of the lecture, and that also travels at the speed of light, the speed that I talked about. It's not light. We call this the speed of light because in Einstein's theory, which comes out of special relativity, there's just one speed. We call it the speed of light because that's the physical thing we use to describe it. And gravitation will travel at exactly the same speed. If that's true, then some phenomenon that happens in the universe will give its information, gravitational information, to us at the same time as we get the electromagnetic or the light information from light. So that's the third prediction of Einstein. He thought that this particular one would probably never be seen. And why, you'll see how hard the technology is, he didn't envision. He envisioned an awful lot in the future, but he didn't envision what could be developed technically to be able to attack this kind of problem. And you'll see why it's so hard as I proceed. There already is very strong evidence for gravitational waves. So it isn't that we don't know there are gravitational waves. The evidence comes from these two gentlemen, Hulse and Taylor, and they produced evidence for it by studying what are called pulsar systems. They studied a pulsar system with a fancy name. They're all labeled with numbers. Using a radio telescope, the Arecibo radio telescope that's in Puerto Rico. What did they do? What they did is to study neutron stars. So I have to tell you what a neutron star is in the simplest possible way I can. It's a very exotic object that's in the universe. What it is, generally, is an object that's produced by the collapse of something like our sun or a star. What do I mean by the collapse first? If you take a star and it burns, what keeps it there is a balance between gravity trying to collapse it, pulling on all the protons and neutrons and so forth that make it up, and the fusion process in the burning causing a pressure outwards. And it's the balance of that that keeps it going. Once a star burns up enough of its fuel, then it gets to a point where gravity wins and it collapses. When it collapses, the masses still stay. They collapse into a very small space. And that's what's called, and tends to be almost all neutrons. I won't go into that why, but almost all neutrons. And they're collapsed into a very small size that's about the size of downtown Vancouver. So in that size, you have an object that weighs more than our sun, about 1.5 times our sun, and it's just packed with neutrons. So that's the object that they looked at. These objects have been seen for a long time, and they have particular features. Sometimes they have features which will give us radio signals, and they studied radio signals. The radio signals come about when you have this object. So you have this small object. It's about 12 miles across, and it spins around. And as it's spinning, it has an axis that it spins around, which is shown here. It also tends to have charged particles and currents and so forth, so it has magnetic and electric fields, and if the axis of that is not the same as the axis that spins, then it looks a little bit like a lighthouse. So as it's spinning around, it basically does this picture here. The beam of radio waves in this case, point at you turns around and faces you. And that can happen 10 times a second or 100 times a second. And they studied an object, a neutron star, for a long period of time that was a very good source to study neutron stars. Obviously, a neutron star is a very complicated object. They used radio waves to study the neutron star, and they noticed something. They noticed this neutron star, which in their case was one that was spinning 17 times a second. So you have the neutron star and it's giving the radio signal that goes boop, 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 17 times a second. And as they monitored it for over a long period of time, they noticed that it actually changed its frequency a little bit every 8 hours. So that every 8 hours it went a little bit faster, a little bit slower, and so forth. And after a while, they concluded from that they weren't actually just looking at one neutron star, but there were two neutron stars, one going around the other, where the first one is the one that they were studying, is turning around at 17 times a second and giving radio signals, and that there was a second one that they didn't even know was there that's taking about 8 hours to go around. And by seeing in detail how it changed this measurement they were making, they were able to conclude how far away this was, how elliptical this orbit was and what all its features were. And they did this in great detail, and they got this set of numbers, which I give here. And that is that they, by looking at this system very, very carefully and monitoring it, they measured how far apart they were. And so these were two objects that were a million miles apart. They also, each of them, were about 1.4 times the mass of our sun. That's the typical mass of a neutron star, so that's why they're labeled as neutron stars. This last number here is just a number, but what it tells you is how elliptical this orbit is, how far away it goes and comes back each time. Those, I write down those numbers because with those four numbers, I can go back to Mr. Einstein and calculate exactly a prediction, which is that as this goes around and accelerates, it should radiate some of this gravitational waves or gravitational radiation. That's what Einstein would predict. As it radiates away some energy into this gravitational waves, this will speed up just a little bit. So they get a little bit closer together. So what you expect, taking a general relativity, is that each time these two objects, which are a million miles apart, go around each other, they'll become about 3 millimeters closer together. Not very much. But if you wait a million years, they'll come together. I don't have a graduate student with that much patience. And he calculated that you can calculate then from Einstein's equation exactly then how this 8-hour period will change with time. And they were very patient. They measured over 20 years. And they got the graph here. These smiling faces are because they won the Nobel Prize for this. And what's shown here is the starting point when they first measured it. The zero up on top, if you can read it, doesn't really matter, is basically the 8 hours it took to go around. And what they measured is how much it speeded up. This is a total of 30 seconds from here to here, that out of 8 hours it speeded up. Instead of 8 hours, it's 8 hours minus 30 seconds after 20 years time. And the line and the dots are the difference between what they measured and what's calculated by Einstein's theory. And the fit is exactly perfect. So, and it's not just a random curve or something. So this was very, very strong evidence. And these two gentlemen won the Nobel Prize for this discovery, as I said. Okay, so the job that we've taken on since then is to actually detect and use gravitational radiation as a tool directly, so that we see the radiation, not just infer it because there's some system that's radiating it away, but actually to detect it directly. And to do that, I have to tell you a little bit about what the nature is of gravitational waves themselves. So let me try to do that. If I take a system like the one they talked about, I call it compact binary in spirals. What that means is two compact objects like neutron stars, and they're spiraling in toward each other. So that is a little... my movie doesn't work. Oh, it works there, not here. So this little movie is a picture of how these came together, calculated on a supercomputer. And when they come together, there's kind of three times that matter. First, they come together in what we call the in spiral. As they come together, the frequency gets faster and faster. That's the minus 30 seconds. It gets faster and faster. And the amplitude, because they come closer and closer together, gets larger and larger. We call that the in spiral part. It's the part that can be calculated really well using Einstein's equations. And it's a signal that we call a chirp. It's like it goes whoop. It increases its frequency and it increases its amplitude with time. That we can calculate. We know how to do that. We start learning other things if we can see it merge itself, like in here. Once it merges, we have no idea how to calculate it. So there, we're starting to study something new about the universe if we could do that. And then finally, when they've merged together, like that picture there, it has to settle down into one object. And so there's the last part of it, which we call the ring down, which is kind of how it settles down to be one new object in the end. So that's the idea of the kind of phenomenon that might happen in the universe that we want to try to observe. Okay, so how do you observe it? What happens? Again, if we look at this picture of the Earth, if a gravitational wave goes through it, there it is. You can see it'll distort the object itself. So let me just do that one more time, and you can see the Earth will get distorted by the passage of the gravitational wave. Okay? I'll come back to that in a simpler way and what that means for a detector in just a minute. There's two approaches you can use. There's some object, so in this cartoon, that's going to make a gravitational wave. In this case, what I've drawn is two objects spiraling around each other, just like we just talked about. So an in spiral of two neutron stars, they're going to emit gravitational waves. One way to approach detecting those is to put detectors in space. There is a proposal to do that, and that's called LISA, and it'll put detectors in space. I think I've got another slide of that, which I'll show you in a minute. But the second way is to do it on the ground, on the Earth, and that's what I'm going to spend most of my time on. They actually are very complementary. If you look at the space experiments, they measure very low frequencies. These are very good for certain kinds of phenomena, like looking at very large, massive black holes, one of the most exotic things we have in the universe. While looking at high frequencies lets you look at the most violent events that happen in the universe, like a collapse of a star or the in-spiral and merger of binary systems, like I talked about. And they are separate from each other. And the reason we do both is very much like the reason that we do look at different wavelengths in astronomy. One of the biggest advances in astronomy in the last 20 years probably is that it's done now over the same objects are looked at for very different wavelengths. So we now have the optical band, which is what we see with our eyes, shown right here. But when we do astronomy now, we do it from very low frequency radio waves all the way to very high energy gamma rays, and that's a band that's much, much broader. And it's looking at what happens in these different frequency bands that allows you to get enough information to understand very exotic things in astronomy. So the fact that we want to do that also for gravitational waves, which is another source of studying the universe, is very similar. So the LISA project is to put three satellites in space. These satellites are separated from each other by 5 million kilometers, and they form a triangle. That triangle actually is put in orbit behind the Earth. It trails the Earth. So as the Earth goes around the Sun, it trails the Earth by about 20 degrees, and it's tilted at about 60 degrees from the Sun itself. And that's an orbit that allows you to both communicate with it and for it to have a way over a period of time of determining the parameters of gravitational waves. Okay. I'm not going to talk about art, but I'm going to use this picture of Leonardo da Vinci's Vitruvian Man to illustrate what the effect is of a gravitational wave, maybe a little more locally than showing you the whole Earth, as I did before. What happens is shown in this picture here. And that is that we stretch and squash in perpendicular directions at the frequency of the gravitational wave. So if the object was going around 10 times a second that's emitting the gravitational wave, it's sending us a signal that happens 10 times a second. That would then take this Vitruvian Man and make him taller and then fatter back and forth 10 times a second. And so that's the idea. He's going to get taller, or think of yourself as going to the amusement park where they have these mirrors that make you tall and thin and short and fat, and you go back and forth between them. So space gets distorted so that you get a little taller and thinner, a little shorter and fatter, a little taller and thinner, shorter and fatter. And now we're going to try to build a device to detect that. And that's what I'll tell you about next. So the idea is shown here. And that is, this is something getting fatter and taller. As it gets fatter, it conserves the total space. So it gets shorter and fatter, taller and thinner, and back and forth at the frequency of the gravitational waves. And we use that picture there to guide us to build an instrument that can detect this in a very accurate way. And that's called an interferometer. And what it does is similarly detect the difference in how long this arm is compared to how long this arm is. That's what an interferometer does. It's a beam of light that comes, strikes a mirror, goes down these two arms, and by comparing how long it takes to go down one arm compared to the other arm, you're able to determine whether one got longer, one got shorter, and so forth. And so that's the technique. I'll talk just slightly more about that in a minute. The problem is, I showed you this picture, but I wasn't very honest. I very much exaggerated the effect. If I actually took the Vitruvian Man and told you that he was 4.5 light years tall, he would only grow by a hair's width. So the effect is really small. And that's the effect we're trying to measure. So how do we do that? I'm going to talk just a little bit more about what you have to do in this interferometry, which is the magic technical trick, which Einstein didn't know about, that we use to do this. So we have somehow distortions of space-time, or if we put a ring of objects that are going to distort like this at some frequency, and we want an object to measure it. How well do we have to do? I've written a couple numbers here. The reason, the translating the numbers that were the Vitruvian Man's 4.5 million light years and a hair width to the numbers that I need for my instrument, I've done here. The strength of this signal that I know is going to distort this is something with 21 zeros on it, 10 to the minus 21 power. And the size of the instruments that I'm going to show you are 4 kilometers long. That translates to trying to a challenge to measure a difference in distance on the Earth's surface, since I'm not going to make something 4.5 million light years long, that's 10 to the minus 18 meters. And I'll come back to what that means for a scientific instrument. So we use a laser interferometer to do this, and that's just a picture of kind of how it works. It basically gives no light as long as the two arms are the same length. But as the arms change length, you get a signal and you measure how much light there is and how that varies with time. And that's your ability to do this. I'm not going to go into the technical details in very much detail. Just give you a schematic picture. And then I'm going to show you some pictures of the instrument in a minute. The first thing that we have to do is to just draw you a picture of this interferometer. The first necessary ingredient is a source of light that can give enough light in a very controlled way to be able to make this measurement. And again, in Einstein's time, this device didn't exist. So we use a very special, what's called a laser. Well, we all use lasers now. They're in our CD players and everything else. But in Einstein's time, there was no such thing. So the laser beam is shined out at a mirror. And then it goes into these two long arms, and these arms are 4 kilometers long. This device then, as the wave passes through, these two arms change with respect to each other, and that causes a little bit of an effect on this photo detector, and that's the little light that I was showing you. So that's the idea. I've shown it to you twice, and again, the distance I'm trying to measure is 10 to the minus 18 meters. So let me remind you how small 10 to the minus 18 meters is, just in case you don't have a good feel for it. So we all know how long a meter stick is, or a yardstick in the U.S., but it's the same thing. So a meter is 40 inches long. A human hair is 100 microns, and that's 10,000 times smaller than a meter stick. Let's keep going. The wavelength of light, the light that we're seeing from these lights in the roof, or the projector here, are 1 micron typically, and that's 100 times smaller than the human hair. And it's the reason we actually can look at the human hair and focus it. If light was actually longer, we couldn't focus and see how big see sharply as human hair. An atomic diameter, atomic physics, is 10,000 times smaller than the wavelength of light. That's getting pretty small. We can keep going. Particle accelerators, like at Triumph, study things that have a nuclear diameter. They're 10 to the minus 15 meters, or a factor of 100,000 smaller than an atomic diameter. And what we're trying to do is a factor of 1,000 smaller than that. So this is really a challenging problem. To do this, we've built 2 big, super high-tech interferometers. One, not so far from here, in the state of Washington, in eastern Washington, on the Hanford DOE reservation. And I'll show that to you in a minute. And another one, 3,000 kilometers away from there, in Louisiana, near a part of Louisiana called Livingston, Louisiana. And those two are identical instruments. And we use the two because we want to look for these rare things that happen in the universe, and they will give signals in both at the same time. And there's almost nothing else that'll do that. So we ask for them to give exactly the same signal at the same time. This is Livingston, Louisiana. This is our big interferometer in Louisiana. It's in a great big part of Livingston that's pine forest, commercial pine forest. And you can tell from this picture that it's swamp, which is what Louisiana is. There's no bedrock. We just float. In order to basically build this instrument, we build it up on a berm, which is about 5 meters high here. This is the instrument. To build it up on a berm so it wouldn't get flooded every time it rains, we dug a burrow pit next to it, and the burrow pit immediately filled with water, bass, and other things. Like this guy here, who's our pet. So that's true. Livingston, Louisiana also is a particular part of the states that is a little bit primitive, and our buildings have certain signs of that, and we live with a local environment that's rather interesting. It rains once in a while in Louisiana. Also, that's our access road, so you either can't get in or you can't get out. This is Hanford, Washington. The same instrument, but it's on high desert in a beautiful part of the state of Washington with mountains off in the background. But lest you think there's no problems there, we've had forest fires, believe it or not, in that desert. We've had a DOE vehicle that thought this was a race course across the plain. So, but science moves on. Let me address just briefly what limits an instrument like this. Why do we have the gall to think that we can get to a measurement that's that good? And what limits you finally? We know what limits it, and we work on it very hard. I show here all the kinds of things that would limit it, and to my scientific colleagues, I would spend a lot of time on all these lines down here. I don't want to do that with you. What I want to do is just point out that what's shown here is sensitivity on this side, and that's the same numbers that we talked about before. This is the 10 to the minus 21. It's more sensitive if you go down. And this is frequency this way. The shaded region is where we're sensitive to seeing gravitational radiation. And what limits us from going further is exactly what limits our ears and our ability acoustically. We're sensitive to the acoustic band, and we're limited at the low frequencies by the shaking of the Earth, completely by the shaking of the Earth. Evolution has taken care of that for us in our ears, so we don't hear the fact that the Earth really shakes at 1 hertz. We cut off a little bit above that. In the middle frequencies, we're limited by what's called thermal noise, and that's the fact that molecules and atoms move around in the instruments that we use, and that's also true in the ears. At the highest frequencies, we're limited by the amount of light we have in this instrument. You're limited in your ears by the fact that at high frequencies, you have to sample quicker and quicker to get the high frequencies, and you can't hear anymore. And so you get the same response in your ears. That's the part of the Earth that's quietest. That's the region that the Earth is quietest for an instrument or for us. And so we work in that region. So we work in the region of 10 hertz to 10,000 hertz, more or less. And as I say, it's limited by those three things. We've built the instruments. So far, they're not limited by any of those things. They're limited by what happens in a real experimental situation. We're limited by our ability to put things together well and keep it quiet. We're limited by electronics, acoustic noise, how well we align the instrument, just all the practical things. And I'll show you the same curve for the real instrument, which is shown here. And we've spent 2 years improving it toward this line, which is our design. And you can see we're quite close now. And in fact, this isn't even our most recent curve. So we're easily within a factor of 2 of the design. And once we get to the design, which should happen later this year, we'll start our most sensitive searches. The instrument already can detect things. This is an earthquake off the coast of Australia. Not very impressive. You can buy a little seismometer and do that. This is a little better. This is detecting the earth tides. What are the earth tides? Earth tides are when the sun or the moon move over your head. It actually distorts the surface of the earth a little bit locally. It pulls and distorts it, if I take Newton's picture anyway. And so what happens is these arms get a little bit longer or a little bit shorter. And this basically shows how much longer and shorter they get, where there's both the prediction, knowing the geology, and where the moon and the earth is. It was a summer project for a Caltech student, and then the measurement on top of it, which actually shows the stretching of the earth and the sun. There's a whole bunch of signatures and so forth, and I only want to pick one to end the talk on to show you just one thing and to ask for your help. There's several. I talked already about neutron star in spirals, and I'm not going to talk about that anymore. It's one of our prime things that we're looking for. We also look for the collapse of stars, gamma ray bursts. We also look for signals that come from the early universe. I'm going to spend the rest of the lecture talking about pulsars, the thing that we talked about earlier, and show you just one set of results and show you one more thing. So I'm going to talk about pulsars, which is a periodic signal. It, if you remember, was a spinning neutron star. So it spins at some 20 times a second or whatever it is, and we try to measure those. We've done that. We've taken the radio sources that have been observed, like at Arecibo, like the experiment that I showed you, and there's 28 prime ones that are known, where everything is known about them, where they are, how fast they spin relative to the Earth. And we looked for those, and we didn't see them. So we've set limits on those that are shown here. And later we'll get more sensitive and we'll look for them harder. But in the meantime, we know that those are not the most likely pulsars to give us good gravitational wave signals. That comes about because of a subtlety. And that subtlety is that as a neutron star gets older and older, it becomes more and more spherical. And the more spherical it is, the less strong the gravitational signal is. So if we can look at young neutron stars instead of old ones, With the present sensitivity of our instrument, we're much more likely to detect gravitational waves soon. So how do we do it? We've looked at those 28 known pulsars, and we don't see a signal. I actually can make a conclusion from that, which is an interesting one, and that is that these objects, this neutron star that's only 12 miles across, actually has no mountains on it that are bigger than about 10 centimeters. If it did, we would detect it. Now, as this neutron star goes around the Earth, it's spinning, and its frequency changes just a little bit because of its relative motion compared to the Earth. It's something that's going around the Earth, and it does what we call a Doppler shift. And so we know that the frequency doesn't just stay at exactly 10 times a second or 100 times a second, but has a predictable change from that. The second thing that happens as it goes around the Earth is the orientation of this object relative to our instrument changes, and our instrument is not equally sensitive in all directions. So we also know that the amplitude of the signal will change, both of these in predicted ways. So we use this as part of the signal to look. But if we look for these 28 objects, that's not so bad. But if we want to look in an unbiased way at the sky for these young pulsars, it's an enormous problem because we don't know the frequency. We have to look at all frequencies. We have to look at all places in the sky. And we have to look at all these frequency and amplitude modulations. And it turns out to be an enormous computing challenge, way beyond what we're able to do. So what we've done is develop, in conjunction with this Einstein year and the American Physical Society, a way to help us do the problem. So we've invented something called Einstein at Home. And Einstein at Home, we didn't invent, really. The idea was taken from SETI at Home, if people know what that is. SETI at Home is looking for extraterrestrial life. This idea is to use the background cycles in people's homes' computers when they're attached to the internet to help us get enough computing power to look for these events, looking at our real data. So if you take now a $599 computer from Radio Shack, it's pretty powerful. So if you add those up, you can do very well. And so we've taken and done that, and we introduced it just a month ago, I guess, at the AAAS meeting, and we now have 35,000 users already. This shows the users and their cycles, how many times they've done it, and we're already able to analyze 20 times more data than we can with our own computers, just using these background cycles on people's home computers. So the rest of the talk is a little bit of a sales pitch. Anyone who joins this gets to write their own little blurb on our website, and so this is just a couple of our users, just to give you a feeling of what kind of people do these crazy things. This guy is from Germany, and he's been interested in, he writes he's interested in physics and astrophysics for a long time. And actually, when he isn't playing these instruments, he designs the interiors of Mercedes automobiles. Another random person is this guy here. And he is an English teacher, but he seems to like the outdoors. He lives in Santa Fe, and he says he likes all those things. Here's a few other of our users are the pictures they sent of themselves. If you join, you get a beautiful screensaver. The screensaver moves where the star, when the stars are moving, you actually see where LIGO, the two LIGOs are on your screensaver. And you can see where it's searching at any given time. We download a little bit of data on each computer. We actually take the same data and randomly do it on three computers, so we make sure we get back data that's comparable. And it can all be found basically on this website here, and it's very easy to join. So I'm going to end there and answer questions. Thank you. The money to build LIGO came from the National Science Foundation, and fortunately, the National Science Foundation believes in very forefront science in new directions, and actually believes in risk-taking, which you need to do for this. So it took some persuading on our side, but basically I think the fact that we have an agency that's not a mission agency like NASA or DOE that supports science and has that kind of goal, it's hard to sell them something quite this expensive, is the reason really underneath. How much? Yeah, the construction, just the construction part was about $300 million.
Why is the Einstein Cross in Australia not an Einstein ring?
Because the lens isn't... I'm sorry. The question is, why is the Einstein Cross not an Einstein ring? Why, when you have an object behind, doesn't it come out a ring? And actually, if you look at different... I'm going to give you a kind of a talky answer. But if you have different objects in the sky that you look at, other ones, some of them are little arcs. This one happens to be this way. The problem is that it isn't really a lens. If you take a lens, which is kind of the picture you're drawing for yourself, then when I take an object behind it focuses. It's not a lens. It just, the formulas don't work that way. Instead, when you come close, what you have to do is just find the right trajectory around that particular object, and it's moving in the sky and so forth, so that it gets to your eye. So it's just the fact that some light is being bent that you see some of it. In some objects, it comes out an arc. In this one, it comes out across. And it comes down to the fact that it's really not acting like a real lens. It is focusing in the sense that it's bending, but not focusing.
Just the right spot, it could be a
ring? If you had just the right spot and the right object and everything was spherical and nothing was, and they were moving together, then you could get a ring. But most things that you get are little arcs or things like this.
Barry, there's a general theorem that nature is user-friendly. When you build a new instrument that has a sense of humor, it will suddenly provide you with something fantastic, like it did for Super Kamiokande when it was turned on, suddenly provided Shelton 1987A, the supernova explosion. Are you now sitting there expecting nature to be user-friendly again?
Absolutely. I think it's especially been true in the question is, you know, I showed how hard it is to do everything, and I'm predicting it, and then we're going to try hard. But won't nature actually do something that'll surprise us and give us a great discovery that isn't just the thing that we've calculated? And of course, we're counting on that and expect it. Astronomy has been especially that way, that almost in any area of astronomy, I showed one graph where I showed all the different wavelengths that have been opened up in astronomy. Every time they've opened a new wavelength, it's a band. It's basically opened up a new field of astronomy. And here we're going to a much more radical change. We're going to do astronomy for the first time not looking at light, but looking at something completely different. We know that when we look at the universe, only 4% of it is luminous. The other 96%, we've got a lot of conjectures, but we don't really know what's out there. And so the fact is, we've only been able to look with light. And being able to look with something totally different has got to lead to surprises. And so I think it's bound to be user-friendly, or whatever words you use. Yeah. Yeah, the question was something that he read called inertial dragging as being a test of Einstein's theory of general relativity that was recently announced. And let me answer that a little bit more generally than just that question. The first thing that I showed you was a verification of Einstein's theory, that we saw the bending of light and that it was right. And there's been various other tests of general relativity. The one of the tests that starts to become more unique and maybe a little different than just the bending of light is frame, what they call frame dragging, which I can't take the time to explain. And there's been a satellite experiment that has taken many years to get up that's consistent with this frame dragging. Those aren't the deepest tests of the theory. We don't really know. We know conceptually that this thing's right because it has things like the bending of light, it has frame dragging. But the guts of the theory, we don't know. And to know whether the theory is really right, the theory of gravity that I'm talking about is really right, we have to get into what's called the strong field limit. Everything that's been done in this case so far is a little teeny bend of light as it goes around bend of light as it goes around the sun, or this frame dragging, which is a very small effect. The big questions are, for example, where does general relativity come in explaining things where gravitational effects are really large, like black holes that suck everything up? And that's the hope that we can get to eventually, is testing general relativity or testing gravity in the places where gravity is really strong. And then we can find out whether Einstein's theory is really right or some alternate formulations. There are alternate formulations. They'll have the same simple things that I talked about, but the deeper things, I think, are going to take real experimental exploration. So one of the things that we hope, and you can ask why we're working so hard to detect gravitational waves, that's just the beginning to be able to test the theory of general relativity in its real fundamental way. And as I said before, to use it as a new probe for the universe. That test that you're talking about would have been very surprising if it didn't yield what you read. Yeah, there's that. You're right about that. And the second thing is that I've seen the data. I don't know, maybe you have also. And it wouldn't stand up by today's standards. We wouldn't have published that paper by today's standards. But he was right. So. Well, I'm not going to answer you because I posed at the beginning essentially that question. This whole theory of general relativity, I can't imagine how he worked. Not only did he come up with it, he was willing to slave and work at it for 10 years. He solved all these other problems in a few weeks. So somehow deep in him, he had the belief that this was going to lead to really important stuff. But I don't know why, because it just kind of came out of the blue. Yeah, there is. The question really was this personal computer, using people's personal computers, what's the competition? What are the other things that are going on doing the same thing? I'm not sure I know everything, but most of it, the one that's been the most successful in terms of getting people to sign up and use it is SETI at Home, and that's the people that we went to. And it turns out the people, SETI at Home is the one looking for extraterrestrial life. We went to them First, you can't, for all science problems, you can't use people's personal computers. You have to have a science problem that you can divide up in little teeny pieces and send out to a lot of computers and bring back little teeny pieces. Ours happens to be that way because we can look at different pieces of the sky, different frequency bands. We just divide the whole problem up. So we didn't develop the software. The software was developed by a company called Boink, B-O-I-N-C. And we adapted our software to work with their software. And they have SETI at home, they have us, they have weather prediction, and there's three or four other ones. I think we're now already, after a month, in second place. SETI at home has 10 times more users than we do, but I think we've moved into, you can go on their website and they have the statistics for the different users, and we've already, we've got a fair amount of publicity because of Einstein and stuff, I think it's about four or five different things. I don't remember what the others were. How much is it what? I'm not sure. Let me repeat the question. Somebody may have to help me because I'm not sure I know what you're asking yet. The question was, when we do the distortions of the length of these arms in our instrument, how much of the mathematics of determining that is dependent on conic sections, she said. I don't do it that way, so I'm not sure that I'm inconsistent with it, so I don't really know the answer to that. You don't have to use conic sections to analyze the problem. In our case, the problem is actually a funny one because you may want to say something else. I'll let you in a second. The problem is a little bit of a funny one because Einstein's theory, of course, the light that goes between the arms can also get bent. So we have to be very consistent about how we treat the problem. Does the light get bent? Do the objects at the end get moved? And it requires using general relativity in a particularly consistent way to get the answers right. So I don't know the answer. I don't know quite what you're asking about using conic sections. It just isn't the way I calculated it. There's no unique way of doing it, though. Did you want to say something else? Okay. Thank you. But it's a bargain. It only costs another $186 million. We proposed how to improve it already for $186 million. It takes a lot of nerve. We haven't done anything yet. We already approved it. We've been approved by everybody except the guys that give you the money, which is Congress. So the National Science Foundation has actually approved that, and we expect to, I'll tell you how much it improves things in just a minute. We expect, and why they're willing to kind of go for it immediately. We expect to start on that in 2008. So we'll use this instrument for the next 3 years and then improve it. We can improve it a factor of 20, straightforwardly, with more or less not being so conservative as I was here. We've developed a laser that's almost 20 times more powerful than the laser we're presently using. And we'll use that. And we've developed a better system of isolating ourselves from the Earth than we had before. So we've developed the technology that will improve it in terms of the length that I talked about by a factor of 20. It'll improve it in the rate by 20 cubed, 20 times 20 times 20, which is a factor of 10,000. And that's because for every factor of 2 that I get in sensitivity, I can look twice as far out in the universe, and the number of stars that I see goes as the cube of that, as it's the volume. So that's why it pays so much to make any improvements in this instrument. But anyway, we can do a factor of 20 or a factor of 10,000, however you want to calculate it, for $186 million in 5 years' time.
You raised the question of Einstein's motivation for general relativity. Historically, what role did the equivalence principle play in his development of general relativity? Did he believe in it and want to come up with a theory that justified it?
I think he believed in it. I don't know. Maybe that had something to do with it. The thing that makes me so reticent is he spent so much energy and effort on this problem. Would it be something just like that? It's hard for me to kind of figure out why he worked so hard at this.
Often when people teach general relativity, they begin with the equivalence
right.
and say, maybe it's not an accident, that's what he thought. So
it might be. Might be.
The question
was that I didn't give an answer. I gave a question earlier that I don't know why Einstein developed the theory of general relativity. It didn't solve any problems except this little problem of Newton's that, although in the end it did, but it didn't, it really wasn't needed at the time. There's a principle called the equivalence principle, which is a kind of fundamental principle in relativity, used in relativity that some people think was the motivation. I don't really buy that because I think it's too much of an academic problem for somebody to have worked so hard, but I may be wrong.
Question in the popular mind is the word the unified field theory. I don't think that those words are actually mentioned tonight, but this work have bearing on this and so on. Unified field theory?
Yeah. The question is, what does this have to do with something you read about or hear about unified field theory? The big dream of Einstein after he did this for the rest of his life really was to have a theory of unification, which he never did. During the 20th century, the other great subject that developed was quantum mechanics. You use the word field theory. Quantum mechanics is based on quantum field theory. The biggest puzzle that we have in physics today is to reconcile general relativity with quantum field theory. They don't reconcile. We have ideas, something called string theory, that might be an answer but might not. The biggest problem that we have is that we have one description of physics at a microscopic level, what's called quantum field theory, that describes all the elementary particles, its motivation for this year's Nobel Prize, it's what people do on particle accelerators, it's what I've done with a lot of my life. And yet, if you come to anywhere where the two descriptions have to describe the same thing, you can't reconcile them. One of the places is the early universe, another place is black holes. And just in general, mathematically, one's a geometric theory and the other is a field theory. And so we don't presently know, and it may tell you why Einstein's theory won't last another 100 years, that we need some theory or way that we can reconcile the microscopic world with what Einstein's telling us, which is more the universe.
Call it there, and I'll ask Dr. Alan Schroeder to thank our speaker. Dr. Schroeder is the director of TRIME. Here he comes. Well, I'd like to thank Barry for giving us an absolute marvelous sort of talk this evening. I think he's covered a wonderful sort of subject, and it really is a fantastic that over 100 years this theory has been there, and I think Barry now is perhaps within 5 years of actually really making a really fantastic understanding of some of the most marvelous things that are happening in the universe. So I think it given us a wonderful lecture tonight, Barry. And so I'd like to invite us all to thank you for coming here and giving us such a marvelous time.